back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, here with Sean Blackman. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are back with you here today, turning our attention here to some of the ongoing issues coming out of Haiti. Very happy to be joined as we continue the show by Kim Ives, who's the editor of the English language section of Haiti Liberté. Kim, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Eugene and Sean.
Well, very happy to have you here, and some excellent reporting coming out between Haiti Liberté and The Intercept earlier this week, digging deeper into this, I think for many, relatively bizarre story out there of these mercenaries coming from America and Haiti that were then whisked out of the country, and really giving some background to what exactly was going on there. And it seems that it was something of an attempt to prop up the president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse, in the standoff with the prime minister, and to a certain degree also the popular movement there on the streets. So, I mean, if you could maybe just to start here, give us some of this context about why these individuals were there and what they were trying to do to help prop up President Moïse.
Yes, as you say, they were basically brought in by Moïse. He was working through three agents, a guy called Fritz Jean-Louis, who was one of his aides, a businessman called Josué Lecomte, who basically lives in Brooklyn, not too far from BAM in Fort Greene, and a businessman called Gessner Champagne, which is like champagne in English, who was a relation of Michel Martelly. He's married to Michel Martelly's wife's sister, Claudia. And so those three guys basically put together this team of mercenaries, sort of, I would call them special forces rejects or wannabes. They definitely were not top drawer. They put together a really buffoonish plan of going to the bank and essentially stealing, moving from the Petro-Caribe account to an account that Jovenel Moïse would control, $80 million, which is all that's left of the Petro-Caribe money, about $4.3 billion worth of oil revenues passed through Haiti over the past decade, basically from 2008 to 2017. So $80 million is left in the account there, and somehow they were going to take that money and give it to Jovenel. We don't know what he was going to do with it, if he was going to skip town or go try and stabilize the situation. But in any case, this was their plan. But it didn't work. They got picked up by the police outside the bank on Sunday, the 17th of February at about 2. And off started. They were driving in trucks with no plates. They had an arsenal in there, semi-automatic, assault weapons, pistols, satellite phones, bulletproof vests, drones, you name it. So the five Americans and two Serbs were in this mercenary unit. They were taken to the police station down by the airport, what's called the BCPJ. And there they were basically held for 3 days. Well, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. The U.S. Embassy immediately began to pressure to have them released, and on Wednesday they were released. This was completely illegal because the investigating judge of the case is supposed to hear their story and decide what to do. They had come into Haiti illegally. They hadn't gone through immigration. They hadn't gone through customs. They brought weapons with them, which was a violation of U.S. law. We'll get back to that. But of course, Haitian law as well. So the U.S. leaned on apparently Moïse, Jovenel Moïse, the president, and his justice minister, who wrote a letter to the chief of the police station, not even the chief of police, who had refused to release them, but to the chief of the police station, said, you're authorized to let them out. Well, he had no authority to tell them so. But they did release them, and they returned unhandcuffed, totally at ease on a plane to the States, where they were questioned, but told, as a follow-up piece in the Herald and the AP put yesterday, told, don't worry, you know, you guys are getting off. But they should have been prosecuted for illegally exporting weapons, because if you're taking weapons, especially assault weapons, out of the U.S., you're supposed to get a license. They didn't do that. So hopefully this piece will bring a little justice to this situation. So these guys who did this very clumsy stunt and were sort of hoisted by their own petard, you know, get called to account. The larger question, of course, is Jovenel Moïse is trying to consolidate his power. As your listeners may know, he's now in Florida at Mar-a-Lago having lunch or talks with Trump. There's some other Caribbean leaders there, too. Essentially, the U.S. is trying to line them all up for their campaign against Venezuela and Nicolas Maduro. Haiti, under Jovenel Moïse, has joined the U.S. coalition against Venezuela, despite the fact that Venezuela has given Haiti over the past decade $4.3 billion of oil revenues. So the Haitian people are mad about that. I don't know if I can say pissed off, but the fact is they're in the streets in large measure because of this terrible betrayal that Jovenel Moïse has done to Venezuela.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's a very interesting piece. And if nothing else, and speaking to your point there about how acute the protests have become, I mean, the story to me, the fact that this was done so shambolically that elements of the government seem to not want to cooperate with the president there, I mean, it seemed to speak to the deep decay of the current regime there, how precarious it is, coming at an interesting time when Marco Rubio was recently there on the island trying to shore up President Moïse and perhaps pull together some sort of power sharing deal, where obviously President Trump meeting with a number of Caribbean nations. I mean, it really did seem to reflect, you know, how much of an inflection point this crisis seems to have reached in Haiti.
Correct. And essentially, Marco Rubio, who is some sort of Secretary of State for the assault on Venezuela, was there again trying to patch things up, talking about dialogue. Prior to the January 10th Organization of American States vote, where Haiti joined 18 other Latin American nations OAS members in saying that Nicolas Maduro was illegitimate. Prior to that, the U.S. was sort of sitting back, watching, not doing much, not giving much support. But since January 10th, he has made a deal with the devil. They have come and given them all kinds of support. There have been a constant stream of visits between the foreign minister and different government officials in Washington. But I think it's too late. You know, he's too wounded. He's bleeding profusely. The masses are just fed up, and it's just a matter of time, really, before they find some surrogate to put in there. And I think the U.S. is not wed to him. They see that he's on his last legs. But as you say, the situation has just deteriorated to a point of near collapse.
Yeah. And Kim, how do you connect that to this rift between President Moïse and Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Henri Saint? What do you make of that whole sort of tension that's happening between the two of them?
Well, Saint-Jean was a very ambitious politician, a complete opportunist. He was given the post back in August. He was ratified in September because he had a slight oppositional color. He used to be closely associated with Aristide, even though they are daggers drawn now. But the Jovenel government put him in there as some sort of compromise prime minister. But it started to become very apparent that Saint-Jean was looking to get Jovenel's job. So as the demonstrators went into the street demanding Jovenel's head, Saint-Jean was saying, Jovenel said to Saint-Jean, listen, you got to go, you got to resign because, you know, I got to appease the people. And Fayyad said, no, I'm not resigning. They want you to resign. So you resign. Now, if Jovenel had resigned, Fayyad would become president, which was his goal. Now, there was in the opposition kind of two currents. One of the currents was trying to go through the Supreme Court and have Jovenel removed that way. But another current was sort of working behind the scenes with Fayyad to try to get Jovenel out. So part of this struggle, and this goes back to the mercenaries, it seems that the bank that needed to have three signatures, say the bank governor, the guy called Jean-Baptiste Dubois, who we think might be part of the whole plot. Then there was the president and the prime minister also had to sign off on it. So that was why they wanted to move the money to an account just that Jovenel Moïse controlled.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting piece. And I believe there's another big push coming in street protests here in Haiti, if I'm not mistaken, starting on March 29th as well. I mean, I sort of interpreted the Rubio trip to Haiti to really sort of be related to that issue and sort of the feeling, as you said, Kim, that perhaps the game could be up here moving forward. So, I mean, one, I'm curious what some of your thoughts are for the continuation of the popular movement, but two, some of the possibilities that may or may not be out there in terms of what could come after this current government.
Well, yeah, the March 29th is the anniversary of the 1987 ratification of the Constitution. And so a lot of these big demonstrations, like the February 7th one, which is the day Jean-Claude left and is often considered to be the modern birthday of Haitian democracy. So they pick these sort of symbolic dates often for the demonstrations. So March 29th promises to be very large. That was launched by one of the opposition leaders, a guy called Moïse Jean-Charles, who is a little bit at odds with the other big coalition, which is the popular and democratic sector. So will they all join together on the 29th? I think they will. I think it will be a big demonstration. And essentially, if the situation degenerates into one where Haiti is locked down, as the demonstrators said back in February, during the 10 days that nothing was able to be done, no business could be transacted, schools were closed, everything was stopped. If it happens again, you know, the U.S. and business interests, the foreign assembly factory contractors who make a lot of our electronics and clothing, et cetera, you know, they can't tolerate it. And they'll say, listen, we've got to find a solution. So I know feverishly behind the scenes, some working group at the State Department and the embassy are sitting down trying to see who can they plug in as interim president to maintain U.S. interests and U.S. control of this situation. And so I think we can, you know, we don't know who they're going to parachute in or slip in from maybe some opposition member, but there are a lot of theories, and I don't want to glaze over your listeners with all of those, but for sure, this is a real struggle, and they don't have a good grip on power right now, and which is why the revolutionary potential of this moment is so interesting.
Yeah, no, well, and I think the your last sentence there is absolutely crucial. I mean, certainly it's easy to understand that, you know, Haiti is a country that, you know, in many ways has great wealth and for all those reasons that the United States may want to sort of keep it in its orbit. But beyond that, I've always felt that, you know, one of the key factors in U.S. policy towards Haiti is also sort of the threat of a good example kind of push here and what it could mean for some sort of, you know, major overthrow in Haiti for the region itself seems also quite significant.
Well, exactly. As I think we've even said on this show, Haiti has always been the model, the torchbearer at the front. In 1804, it was the first independent nation of Latin America and the touchstone for the revolutions across the continent and through the help they gave Bolivar. In 1990, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's election was, again, the beginning of the pink tide. And he inspired Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, et cetera, to carry out their political revolutions. And now today, again, the Haitians are rising up against not just Donald Trump and all the racist reaction that he represents, but against the neoliberal order, against the Clintons, against the whole edifice that they've built. So in many ways, yeah, the Haitian Revolution, I think and hope it can be a model, really, for uprisings across the globe.
Yeah, and on that note, Kim, because I think that historical point is so important, in terms of today, do you see what's happening in Haiti as having any kind of ripple effect on the rest of the Caribbean? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
Well, yeah, first of all, you have the Dominican Republic right next door, which basically is half Haitian. The Haitians are working and go over there, everybody with a shovel on a construction site or a rag in their hand in the hotel is usually Haitian. And so you have to, you know, wonder how the U.S. Would deal with that if you had essentially a social revolution where property changes hands in Haiti. What effect is this going to have on the Dominican Republic, which is something like, I could say, Honduras in the Caribbean for the U.S., sort of a base. They work very closely with the Dominican military. And then spreading further out, you have to wonder, with Puerto Rico, Jamaica nearby, you know, these are also countries which can be affected by the uprising of the Haitians. And Puerto Rico, of course, is going through the throes of its own imperial punishment, we could say, for especially since the hurricane last year. So I think the example the Haitians are tracing of what the streets can do, of what a rebellion can do, of what standing up against power can do, will be inspirational.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very relevant point, and I certainly think to some degree it already has been, you know, quite inspirational, at least to some of us watching what's going on there. Either way, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I really appreciate you joining the show here, Kim. Again, that's Kim Ives, editor of the English language section of Haiti Liberté, and definitely check out that report that they did in conjunction with The Intercept as well this week. We're going to move to a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We'll be back. Stay with us.